Macintosh Folklore Radio, written by Andy Hertzfeld and Company, and read by Derek Warren. Where Did That Hand Come From? By Eric Barnes. In the mid-1970s, I became San Francisco's first professional male hand model, which is a whole other story in itself. For 3 or 4 years, there were no others in the field, and I built a nice and profitable reputation, shooting hand shots for all manner of products and companies. Around April of 1984, I received a phone call from one of my favorite photographers, Dennis Gray. He wanted to book me for 1 hour and asked me to bring shirts in a variety of colors, a couple of sports jackets, and a suit jacket. After I arrived, the pale blue shirt that I brought was selected, and the photo shoot began. My task was simple. I was to hold this weird little plastic thing in a variety of ways. About 45 minutes later, Dennis thought he had the shot he wanted. I asked him, "What is this thing?" Dennis replied, "Darned if I know. They call it a mouse." 1 year later, I purchased my first Macintosh, a 512. As I unpacked it, I saw that virtually every surface of the boxes, plus all the manuals, featured a photograph of a hand. Oddly, the photograph didn't trigger any memories amidst all the others in which I had been featured. It was only a few days later that it dawned on me. That was my hand. My connection with the Macintosh also brought me a variety of hand shots for Macworld magazine, and it was later pointed out to me that my hand was the only live thing on Macworld covers for its first 5 years of publication. Although I didn't have anything to do with the creation of the Macintosh, I did contribute to its great marketing effort. The mouse shot paid me only $100. I don't suppose Steve would be willing to pay residuals at this late date? Handicapped by Andy Hertzfeld, 1985. Most of the anecdotes that I've written for Folklore are based on incidents that I observed firsthand, but sometimes a second or third-hand story is just too good to pass up. I must issue a disclaimer. I didn't actually witness the punchline to this story, and it certainly seems too good to be true. Steve Jobs was not the most considerate individual at Apple, and had many ways of demonstrating this. The most obvious was his habit of parking in the handicapped spot of the company parking lot. He seemed to think that the blue wheelchair symbol meant that the spot was reserved for the chairman. Whenever you saw a big Mercedes parked in a handicapped space, you could be sure that it was Steve's car. This sometimes got him in trouble, and unknown people would occasionally retaliate by scratching his car with their keys. The story goes that one day, Apple executive Jean-Louis Gasset, who had recently transferred to Cupertino from Paris, had just parked his car and started walking towards the entrance of the main office at Apple. It was then that Steve buzzed by him in his silver Mercedes and pulled into the handicapped space near the front of the building. As Steve walked brusquely past him, Jean-Louis was heard to declare to no one in particular, "Oh, I never realized that those spaces were for the emotionally handicapped." One day at Apple, in October 1983, I received a phone call from the Cupertino Police Department. "You reported a Mercedes parked in the handicapped space in your parking lot at Apple. Well, we sent a car out there, but we can't really tow it away because the handicapped space isn't properly designated." I had no idea what he was talking about. A few hours later, I found out that this was the work of Steve Wozniak, a prolific prankster. Woz had called up the Cupertino police and reported that a silver Mercedes was illegally parked in a handicapped space and told them the person reporting it was Andy Hertzfeld. I decided not to inform Apple's facilities department about the improperly marked space, just in case Woz decided to try again. Are You Gonna Do It? February 1985. No matter how much resolve you could muster, it was always difficult to quit Apple if Steve Jobs wanted you to stay. You would have to sit down with him for a reality distortion session, and Steve was often successful at getting people to change their minds. One day, a few of us were talking about strategies to overcome Steve's persuasiveness. I've got it, said Burl. I know the perfect way to quit that will nullify the reality distortion field. Of course, we wanted to know how he could do that. I'll just walk into Steve's office, pull down my pants, and urinate on his desk. What could he say to that? It's guaranteed to work. We laughed, thinking that not even Burl would have the guts to do that. A year and a half later, Burl felt it was finally time for him to quit after months of scuffling with Bob Belleville and some of the other managers. Some of them wanted to cancel the Turbo Mac project, a redesigned, faster Macintosh based on a semi-custom chip with an internal hard drive. Burl notified the Human Resources Department, along with Bob Belleville, who was probably relieved since he knew that Burl didn't respect him. He also made an appointment to see Steve Jobs that afternoon. When he walked into Steve's office, he was surprised to see Steve grinning at him. "Are you gonna do it? Are you really gonna do it?" asked Steve. Somehow, word about the urination threat had gotten back to Steve, and he was genuinely curious if Burl would go through with it or not. Burl looked Steve in the eye. "Do I have to? I'll do it if I have to." Steve's expression gave him the answer. So Burl turned and walked out of the office, no longer an Apple employee. An early switch campaign, written by Tom Zito, September 1985. My former wife, Laura Botchko, had been a book editor in New York and worked on a project with Bo Derek before we moved to California. One night, when Laura and I were having dinner with Steve Jobs, Bo's name came up, as did Bo's status as a heavy-duty computer jockey, albeit of the IBM persuasion. Steve took this as a personal challenge. He was going to convert Bo to a Mac user, and who knew what else? Clearly, the computer could be a foot in the door. He persuaded Laura to make him an appointment with Bo. And so, one day shortly thereafter, Steve piled into his Mercedes, along with a Macintosh, and drove down to Bo's Santa Barbara ranch, which she shared with her husband, John Derek. Bo was cordial but unimpressed. She accepted the computer but remained a PC user. Apparently, she did not find Steve as dashing as Steve expected she would. Several weeks later, Steve was complaining to Laura about the lackluster impression he had made. "Look," she told him, "she's married, and besides, I don't know any woman who would want her name to be Bo Jobs."